There was an increase in mass shootings last year in Wisconsin and around the country. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there were 11 mass shootings in Wisconsin in 2020 compared to just 3 the year before. Mass shootings in the U.S. as a whole jumped 50% from 2019 to 2020. Those numbers refer to an event where 4 or more people were injured or killed in a shooting. Mass shootings are complex events that are connected to a wide variety of causes and issues, including the mindset of the perpetrator, their access to firearms, and larger societal events like a pandemic or a spike in unemployment numbers. We're trying to understand why mass shootings happen in the wake of a year where they went way up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been affected by a mass shooting? What was that experience like? What do you want to know about why mass shootings happen? And what caused the major increase in them last year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. James Densley is a professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota and co-founder of The Violence Project, which is the most comprehensive mass shooter database in the United States. He's co-author of a book coming out by the same name, The Violence Project, that's due out in September. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about definitions first, because I think a lot of different things might pop into people's heads when I say the words mass shooting. The data I said was 4 or more people killed and injured. That's not the universally used definition. What kind of things do you see out there?
Yeah, the definitions matter. I mean, each one of these events is a terrible tragedy. And I think having a broad definition like the one used by the Gun Violence Archive, you know, it makes a lot of sense because it brings real attention to these issues. But generally speaking, when the FBI or when academics are doing research on public mass shootings, they are referring to 4 or more victims killed, whereas the definition used by the Gun Violence Archive is 4 or more victims shot. Mm-hmm. And also the more traditional definition excludes domestic mass shootings, gang, drug, and organized crime-related shootings, because they have slightly different profiles and the offenders have different motivations than what you generally would think of as a public mass shooting. And the definitions matter because when you hear the word mass shooting, I think it evokes Columbine and Parkland mm-hmm. and Santa Fe and Las Vegas. But that's not necessarily what we're always talking about in these situations.
What do you see when you look at things through the lens of the more commonly used definitions of mass shootings? Did we see it increase or decrease or a level amount in 2020?
Well, actually, this is what's interesting, that if you use the more common definition of 4 or more people killed, we actually saw a decrease across the United States last year. There was obviously the terrible tragedy at the Molson Coors Beverage Company in Milwaukee in February. And then there was another shooting in Springfield, Missouri in March that left 5 people dead. Those, though, were the only 2 that we have included in our database of public mass shootings. And both of those occurred in February and March, and then they stopped. And I think that's partly due to the pandemic, in as much that it's difficult to have a public mass shooting in a public space, like a school or a workplace or a place of worship, when those places are shut down. And obviously with coronavirus, it changed our routine activities last year. And I think that is one of the reasons why we saw a decrease in that more traditional mass shooting.
The mass shootings are just one part of the gun violence story. On the other hand, we had that increase in, maybe we could call them multiple shootings as defined more loosely. And a lot of cities, Milwaukee included, saw increases in gun violence overall from year to year, 2019 to 2020. What do you think's driving that kind of gun violence versus, as you mentioned, the decline in what we think of as the public mass shooting?
Yeah, and that's, I think, really the finer point to put on this, which is that gun violence is really multifaceted, and there's lots of ways in which it affects people's lives. And I think that's why having this sort of broader look at shootings is really important, because across the country, we did see a dramatic increase. And when we dive into the data, if you look at the Gun Violence Archive data, so we found that in about half of the cases that were classified as mass shooting, no one was killed. But the profile of those types of shootings tended to be drive-by shootings, gang-related incidents, fights where the perpetrator and victims had a prior relationship. And those cases were also clustered in America's urban centers. You mentioned Milwaukee as an example. And they tended, the victims and the offenders tended to be people of color. And so what's important about having this conversation is we're really shedding light on the kind of everyday gun violence that's going on in our communities, that's plaguing communities across the United States. And in terms of why we think that might be increasing, I think there's a couple of things. The pandemic has certainly exacerbated some of the risk factors for violence. So a lack of jobs, educational opportunities, the stress and the mental health concerns and other things associated with the pandemic. The other thing we saw, though, is that there was a massive increase in gun sales last year, which I think is related to some of the fear and anxiety associated with a global pandemic and being locked down. And then, of course, we had all the unrest and over racial injustice after the killing of George Floyd and also the events in Kenosha. And I think that in turn has sort of eroded away a lot of the trust that we have in our law enforcement to the extent where we might be seeing communities effectively sort of policing themselves. Officers may be pulling back from more proactive policing because they don't want to be the next headline on the news. There's a diminished trust of law enforcement, so maybe people aren't calling the police as much to intervene with situations in communities. And then you also have more emboldened offenders as well. If they feel like they're going to get away with it because that policing presence isn't there, and they feel like that they have to protect themselves by carrying firearms, you know, those firearms that many people that, you know, that they're holding to protect themselves are actually more liable to endanger others. And so I think all of that creates this sort of like toxic mix, and it results in the number of shootings that we saw last year.
It makes me think we talk about trying to reduce gun violence as a singular thing, but from what you're saying, it may mean that it may sound like there's one approach that we might need for public mass shootings, another for, say, the gang-related violence you were talking about, another still for gun domestic violence, and we haven't even talked about gun-related suicides. There's not really a one-size-fits-all approach, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. And I think actually that's a really important point to make to your listeners, which is there is not one gun violence. There's lots of gun violences, if you will. And they each require a slightly different approach. But I think this is also where often policymakers get stuck because they're always looking for, you know, the one solution that's going to fix everything. And it just doesn't exist. And I think what has happened is we've viewed possible solutions in isolation, or we've created these sort of false dichotomies and pitting solutions off against each other, where we've said, well, that might fix mass shootings, but it's not going to fix, you know, urban gang-related gun violence, for instance. But we have to realize that even when solutions have merit, you know, we can't just dismiss them for being imperfect. It's the imperfections, they don't render these solutions completely useless. What we need is to figure out, it's a bit like Swiss cheese. There's holes in all of these things, but if you layer the slices one on top of each other, the holes get covered up. And if you're layering these imperfect solutions holistically, that's the way you get to prevent mass violence. And so there's things we can do to prevent suicides, which would also have an impact on preventing mass shootings, for instance. There's things that we can do that prevent urban gun violence, which would also prevent gun violence in rural communities too. And it's instead of looking at these things in isolation, I think we have to look at it as the big picture and the way in which they're related to each other.
We're talking to James Densley, professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota and co-founder of the Violence Project. We're looking at mass shootings last year. By one definition, involving four or more people shot, not necessarily killed, they went up. By the definition of public mass shootings where people died, they went down. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Were you paying more attention to gun violence in 2020, or was it crowded out by all the other things going on? Is there a solution you think would help with some of the gun violences out there, the different kinds of gun-related problems? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with James Densley. He's a criminologist who co-founded the largest mass shooter database in the U.S. called the Violence Project. He's telling us about what he's found in his work on the causes of and possible solutions to gun violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, looking at those public mass shootings, I don't need to list them. I think people know the kinds of things we're talking about here. You've talked to people who have been affected by that and some of the perpetrators themselves. What kind of common themes do you see that might give us a clue to helping stop that kind of violence?
Yeah, that's right. We've interviewed perpetrators of mass shootings in prison, and then we've also interviewed people whose lives have been affected by those shootings. And we find that mass shooters tend to have sort of four things in common. So the first thing is they've often had a very traumatic childhood. And in some ways, that comes as no surprise. You know, if you go ahead and perpetrate a crime like a mass shooting, it doesn't come out of nowhere. And, you know, these are very traumatic childhoods of abuse and neglect. That's a common theme. Second thing is mass shooters tend to reach an identifiable crisis point. A marked change in their behavior usually signals that to others. And that's an important piece around intervention, where people actually notice that something is off. And that crisis can often be a suicidal crisis. And that's also important because these mass shootings are intended to be the final act of that individual. They are public suicides. And I think when we think of mass shootings as public suicides, it makes us sort of take stock of really some of the things that we could be doing to intervene earlier in people's lives so they never get to that point in the first place. The third thing is mass shooters study other mass shooters. They get mobilized and radicalized on the internet, looking for models of behavior that they can follow. And what's interesting about last year is one of the reasons potentially that mass shootings declined, at least the public mass shootings that we were talking about, is the sort of lack of a contagion effect, meaning if the media wasn't focused on mass shootings and instead was focused on the pandemic and other things, some of the fame-seeking and notoriety, some of those incentives to perform a mass shooting disappear. And if we stop talking about the events, then perhaps that doesn't motivate other people to go out in search of doing it for the fame that it might bring them. And then the final factor, the fourth, is, of course, the opportunity. You need access to the people and places to perpetrate a shooting. And as I mentioned, the pandemic maybe reduced some of that. But then, of course, you need access to firearms as well. I mean, one of the big striking things that we noted in our research was for school shooters, 80% of the time, because they're young people, they're getting their firearms from their families. They're just not locked up. You know, they're not stored safely. And that's a really simple fix that could actually prevent a lot of pain and tragedy.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hello.
Yeah, I really wonder what's going on, because there's something else going on with all this. I was running into a old boy the other day, and he carried a gun. He had two rifles. He was bragging about all this, and you could tell he was hoping, just praying to get into something. And then I got like my uncles and even my aunt. They were all in World War II. They weren't gun nuts, because they'd been on the receiving end. And, you know, they have a hunting rifle or something, but this business of everybody stocking up on guns and ammunition, and maybe it's TV. I don't know. You got any ideas?
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike's seeing a change in kind of our attitudes toward guns over the generations, James.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that Mike's raised there. I appreciate the call, because there does seem to be a sort of greater attachment to our guns in the United States in the last, you know, two or three decades. You sort of see a shift, actually, between the sort of 1980s to the present day, where all of a sudden we started to really focus more about the use of firearms for personal protection instead of the kind of security of the state, if you will. And that is reflected in Supreme Court precedents and other things, but it's also reflected within our culture, where people are much more sort of attached to their firearms. And there does seem to be a real pushback against any sort of suggestion that, you know, we need to be better regulated when it comes to getting access to them. So I think there's some truth to that, that this is something we are witnessing across the country at the moment.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. One of the things that you mentioned, James, is possible solutions that I think about a lot being a member of the media. When a mass public shooting happens, it's hard to not talk about it. People want to hear about it. It's important news. Do you have thoughts on how to talk about it in ways that don't glorify, that hopefully don't motivate the next potential perpetrator? And I try to say perpetrator instead of shooter, because that, to me, sounds less, I don't know, action movie-ish. Do you have thoughts on how we can talk about that?
Yeah, and I think we can actually draw a lot from the way in which we report on suicide. You know, I mentioned earlier that mass shootings are somewhat linked to suicides. And if we take that and think about how we apply that in terms of solutions, we can report on mass shootings almost like we would do with suicide. So when we talk about that, for instance, we're more likely to point people in the direction of resources. We're less likely to sort of glorify certain actions or fixate over the method of killing and other factors. And I think that is a really important step in the right direction. And then the other thing we can do in our reporting as well is really focus, in addition to solutions, as opposed to the kind of gory details of the events, is really rise and elevate the heroes and the victims of these shootings, as opposed to always being fixated on the perpetrators. There's real stories of heroism and heartbreak. And I think those are the stories that need to be told. And perhaps less emphasis on some of the gory details of the lives of the mass shooters themselves.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us, and I imagine we'll be talking to you in a few months when your book comes out.
I sincerely hope so, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That's James Densley, professor of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota. He's co-founder of The Violence Project. And as I hinted there, he's co-author of the book by that name, The Violence Project. That's coming out in September. We'll likely talk to him again then. He joined us today for a look at mass shootings last year. An increase, if you measure them one way, a decrease when you think of those public mass shootings.